Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So, good evening, everyone, and welcome to our PLP. So, tonight's conversation is going to be about equality, not as something that only happens in committee rooms or in policy documents or in academic spaces, but we are thinking about what does equality look like in practice. We're in a moment where gender, race, and trans rights are routinely talked about as if they're either distractions from real politics or dangerously being overdetermined by culture wars. And I really want us to resist that framing tonight, because these issues are not marginal to political and academic life, but they're central to how power works. We're also in a moment where the language of equality, what we're seeing is becoming very fluent. Institutions, they all know how to say the right things, but knowing the language is not the same as doing equality. And it's not really improving any material conditions. So I'm really pleased to be joined by Sarah Owen MP today, whose political work sits at the intersection of labour, gender, race and equality. Sarah is an ardent campaigner with strong trade union roots who became a Labour MP for Luton North in 2019. Sarah has previously served as an opposition whip, the Shadow Minister for Homelessness and Rough Sleeping, and Shadow Minister for Faith, Communities and Local Government. In September 2024, Sarah was elected as chair of the Women and Equality Select Committee. And to date, she has led a variety of inquiries into topics such as non-consensual intimate image abuse, misogyny in music, puberty blockers, and community cohesion. Sarah also has a depth of experience working as a domiciliary care worker in the London Fire Brigade emergency planning, in local government, campaign organizer. You were a policy officer to Ed Miliband when he was the leader of the opposition, and also as a political officer for a trade union. As chair of Women and Equalities Committee, Sarah actually occupies a space that I would say is both powerful but also very constrained. And I do have questions on that. But her committee has achieved major policy changes, but has also often at times needed to be really combative with the government to get things done. So I'm going to try and keep this not as a very kind of a conventional Q&A. We will talk about gender and power inside Parliament, about trans rights, about the politics of moral panic, about race, migration, about the emotional and political labour that is required to survive and sometimes thrive in those institutions. So thank you for being here, and thank you, Sarah, for willing to have this conversation in public. Can we all give a hand for Sarah? So, Sarah, my first question really is, you're a first in many ways, you know, in Parliament. You're the first MP of Southeast Asian origin. You're called the first woman MP of Chinese descent. But does being a first, you know, how much of this descriptor does it feel like a recognition to you? And how much of it does it feel like a pressure?
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me here. It is a real honour. And do you know what? I was super surprised when you invited me, but I'm really glad to be able to be here. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from everybody and their questions as well afterwards. But I think like that question of a first is really, do you know what? It feels like a burden sometimes, that's perfectly honest. But mostly it annoyed me. It annoyed me that it took so long for there to be an MP in the Labour Party of East and Southeast Asian descent. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of us in this country and we have so much to offer. I can see one now. Hey, Ian. But it was really upsetting to me that within the trade union movement, for example, you would see so few East and Southeast Asians, yet you know how many are in the public sector in terms of in our NHS, in our education system. My mum came to this country from Malaysia when she was just 19 years old to be a nurse, and she gave over 40 years to be a nurse in this country, and yet we didn't have a political voice. And I think the burden really came with my family, not with external pressure. Like, my mum is a terrifying old school matron who's about 5 foot, right? Like, condensed kind of scariness and love in equal measure. But when I said to her I wanted to do international relations at university, she went through me. She went utterly through me. She was like, what do you mean you want to do this? What the hell is it, for a start? She had no idea. And she said, do you want to throw everything away on politics? You're the first one in university, like in our household, to go to university. What the hell are you doing? And she said, why don't you do law? I was like, because I don't want to do law. And she's like, but she could see a clear path. And this kind of burden to prove her wrong was really kind of hard, because I had to carry her expectations, manage her disappointment that I wasn't doing what she wanted me to do. But also, she was coming at it from a place of love and fear for me. I couldn't point to anybody in politics and say, but they've come from the same background as me, or they look like us, or they have the same experience of us. Like, I couldn't prove to her that it could be done until it was done.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the burden that I felt. I feel like you can't really mess up as the first, and that's really hard. But one of the things that I don't want to be anymore is, like, I said it in the speaker's room. The speaker had a reception for International Women's Day. Like, I like to call it a lot more work for women day, particularly in the gender field. But I said, like, we've all had to fight to be in that room. Moira Stewart was in that room. I was like, ah, amazing. There were brilliant athletes. There were brilliant people from television, from literacy. Like, there were just so many amazing women in that room that had all been the first or been extraordinary in their field. And I was like, all of you have had to been the first or extraordinary in the field to be in this room. And I was like, what I want for future generations is that women don't have to be extraordinary or be the first to be in that room. And I want that for every room across the country. And that's kind of where it feels for me when I talk about when I get asked about being the first, because I just don't want to be the last, and I'm glad I'm not.
You're definitely not. And I think that's a really nice way of framing this, Sarah, because, you know, it is visibility, but also it comes with a certain kind of burden, like you said. And does it feel extractive at times? Do you think the party, people around you, do feel it extractive, like being the first?
I do sometimes. I mean, I think, like, for the party, it used to be like, oh, we'll all out some people for Lunar New Year. Me having to get them to say, oh, it's not Chinese New Year, by the way, it's Lunar New Year. But actually finding your space within those places as well, which are not, you know, I went to my first, it was traditionally called Chinese for Labour, and Lord Sunny Leong was there. He wasn't a Lord then. We didn't have any East and Southeast Asian representation. And then I got involved with this, and I walked into this room, and I hadn't realised that politics didn't look like me. I just kind of accepted it was kind of white guys called Josh in a suit, right? And then when I walked into this room, I must have been in my early 20s, and I was like, oh, here's where people who look like me are in the Labour Party and within politics. And I felt really sad at that moment. I felt like at home, but I felt really sad that I hadn't been in that space before. And that's when I knew I really wanted to get involved and see more and more people come. And so when I became vice chair and worked with Sunny as chair in different guises, Sunny and I were just like, why are we called Chinese for Labour? I was like, we're both Malaysians. What the hell? And, like, we may have Chinese ancestry, we may have Chinese heritage, but, like, I kind of feel a bit fraudulent. And both of us also don't speak Mandarin. Like, there's so many levels of imposter syndrome that was going on with me right then. But also I realised that we weren't getting the full diaspora of East and Southeast Asian people in the UK. And as soon as we changed it to EC for Labour, and we had to take people on a journey with that, while also recognising the work that people had done to set up Chinese for Labour in the first place. But immediately, as soon as we did it, we had fantastic people come forward. Filipinos, we had Japanese, we had Korean, South Korean. Like, it was amazing. And now, Sunny and I, we're like the old auntie and uncle. Like, I go to EC for Labour events, and I'm like, I'm old. And I love that. That's what I want. And when I say that Sunny and I might be the first in some ways, we're not the last. And I'm so happy. I can just rest assured that I know I'm not going to be the last. Because you've got people like Tony Vaughan, you've got people like Yuan, you've got people like Jessica Rosato that have come forward. We've gone from one to four, and one of the Lords. Let's just keep growing. That's what I want.
Absolutely. And just sort of, you know, you've just started to tell us a little bit about that trajectory, Sarah, and I'm very interested, you know, because before Westminster, you know, actually when I first met you, you weren't an MP.
No, I was normal. Working...
You were working in a trade union, you were into local organising, And I'm quite interested, how did that shape you? You know, what did you learn within those trade union movement spaces that you kind of, you know, what I think Parliament still hasn't kind of caught up with much of it.
No, because I think Parliament is so separate from the people that they serve in some regards. But I think trade unions, it comes from the ground up, and politics still works from the top down. And I think that that's what politics could learn from the trade union movement. I think particularly the more that we see politics move away from that space, and I mean all parties, and there are parties that are pretending to be the voice of workers, I think the worst will be off in this country. We've just got like landmark legislation through in terms of the Employment Rights Bill, but it has been a slog to get there. It was blocked numerous times in the House of Lords. There are people that just do not know the difference it will make to ordinary workers' lives. And I think that the trade union movement, it saddens me that it seems that the trade union movement has taken a step back from party politics as if it's not a space for them anymore. We need to have workers' voices within politics. Otherwise, it's going to be left to the elite. And we know where that ends up.
Mm. And that is happening. I think people who are claiming themselves to kind of speak for the workers' rights movements, and, you know, we've just seen where that's going. Just kind of staying on with this trajectory of kind of from trade union to where you've gone, how much do you think your kind of politics has also shifted or hardened by that? And I remember we were just talking in the green room about this, right, in 2019 when I was a candidate in Southeast England, and I was telling you about the kind of really horrible racism I faced. You told me about your experience in Hastings.
Yeah.
How much did that shape your politics now?
I think I've always been fairly hardline. I think it cemented it. And it cemented that I am not the problem, that you are not the problem. We are not the problem here. And I think we are often made to feel like we are the problem. The racism, the misogyny, the homophobia. It's like, no, you're the problem. No. I think every experience that I've had along the way has made me realise and harden the fact that I'm not the problem. And I am not here to make you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
That is not my job. That experience in Hastings, most of the time was nice. Like, I grew up in Hastings. I grew up in the 80s. It's a seaside town. It suffers incredibly from poverty. But it was very white during the 80s. Like, there were very few kind of diverse faces and families around. And I stood for election there first. I was a candidate from 2011 to 2015. That's a long time to be a candidate. And I lost. And it was hard. And I felt like I'd let a lot of people down. I also felt like I'd been dumped by the entirety of my hometown, which is pretty harsh. But my mum saw something on Facebook, and it gutted me, because some bloke had put, well, she's not even English, on a Facebook post. I'm glad she didn't win, she's not even English. And my mum phoned me and she said, is it because I'm Malaysian that you didn't win? And it ripped at me. And I said, no, mum. I was like, if that man does not like my ethnicity, wait till he hears about my views on gender. Wait till he hears about my views on workers' rights, because I can guarantee you that that hatred doesn't stay in one lane. If he's going to hate me for who I am and who my parents are, he's going to hate me for everything else that comes out of my mouth as well. And I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, and I think it's made me more determined to be proud of who I am and be as I am. I'm fairly unfiltered. It gives people like Jenny, who work in my team, probably palpitations every time I get up in front of a mic, and I apologise. But I think it's made me a better... It's not just made me a better politician. I think it's made me understand myself more and also never take anything for granted, definitely.
To be blunt, how gendered is Parliament? Because, I mean, you know, the language around sexism, I think, has improved. People know how to talk the talk. But has it actually changed anything? It's a bit of a...
Do you know what? I'd say that the people within the rooms have changed, definitely. And some of them may change the language. You know, I was just part of this fantastic project by the Royal Photographic Society, which is, they've got a 40% project, and they've got women photographers who are taking photos of the 40% of women MPs. Like 40%, that's pretty good. It's not 50%, and it's not more than 50% where it kind of should be. But, like, to say that before 2024, just, we wouldn't have expected it, I don't think. Do I think it's got better? People know what they shouldn't say, but does that mean they're still not thinking it? Mm. Probably not. Do I still get times where I'm walking with one of my male team members and somebody shakes their hand? Cameron has to go, no, she's the MP. Like, this still happens. When I was shadow minister, I was walking and there was two political journalists. And I was walking with Jonathan Ashworth to an event. And I didn't get bothered once. And I was like, this is awesome. And then I was just walking along and the journalist went, and he's a lobby journalist, said, oh, so how long have you been working for Jonathan? And I don't work for Jonathan. I work for the people of Luton North. And he was like, he went bright red, absolutely shocked. And I wasn't a new MP at that stage, you know, I wasn't. And I, in my older, like in my younger days, I probably would have gone out of my way to make him feel okay about that. Not now. Not now. I don't, like, that's not my shame. That's not my burden to make him feel better for his ignorance and assumptions. So I think it's got better to a larger extent for the public facing side of it. I think it hasn't shifted the genuine attitudes to where it needs to be within there. Not one bit. Not one bit. When we've got MPs who are welcomed with open arms, who have been convicted for abusing their girlfriends, and we're expected to work with them every single day, and I'm expected to feel safe in that workspace. Nah. Nah. We've got a long way to go.
And I really, really loved your speech recently that you gave in Parliament about trans rights, which is really where I'm going to go into my next question. And I remember there was one sentence over there where you said, it wasn't trans people who made me feel unsafe, but it was actually the cis men. And I thought that was such a powerful speech. And actually, that is my next question, and I do want us to spend some time on this. It has become such a polarized issue. Mm. And I think, you know, as the chair of Women and Equalities Committee, what do you think politicians are getting wrong when they talk about trans lives?
I think that they are not looking at this from a rights-based issue. They are looking at this through a political agenda lens. They're looking at it from a point of view of shock jock, kind of, what can I get on TikTok? What can I get on X? I mean, Kemi Badenoch is apparently choosing her next shadow cabinet based on how many Facebook likes they get. Right? And we already know how screwed the algorithms are. We already know that the more hateful you can be, the more you're going to get shared, the more you're going to get liked. And that distorts the genuine nature of political debate and rhetoric. I am fine to have conversations with people that I don't agree with. I absolutely love it. But does it have to be disrespectful? Does it have to be hate-filled? Does it have to be completely unevidenced? Because if we were looking and talking about women's safety, we wouldn't be talking about trans people. We really wouldn't. And that was the point I was making. And when I said that it's not just cis men that are the ones that I've ever felt uncomfortable around, it's cis men with power. Mm. Cis men with unaccountability. Like, they're just not accountable to anyone. I remember standing up, I think it was before Lee Anderson became Reform, and we were in the chamber, and I was talking about the shameful rape conviction statistics, which were under 2%. And I said that rape had effectively been legalised in this country. That's not, like, it's a shocking fact, but it's a fact. Because if you've got a 98% chance of getting away with it, and those are just the ones that had been reported, to me, that's effectively legalised. And I was told to sit down. I was told that I should be careful because I would be encouraging men to commit this. Again, not my burden, not my responsibility. I'm pointing out the facts. But yet, if any of us talk about trans rights, it's that we are somehow stifling the debate on anything else. And for me, I look at it like, if you want me to fight for your rights, whichever protected characteristic you're in, you need to also allow me to have the space to fight for other individual rights as well, because you do not get to choose which rights you fight for and which ones you do not. If you believe in human rights, you believe in all human rights. And for me, trans rights are human rights.
So Sarah, there is that kind of political calculation that you said, you know, people are doing. There is misinformation, there is moral panic, there's all of this. And I just want to, like, you know, for some people, you know, kind of keeping this debate permanently inflamed, do you think there's an advantage that is literally why a lot of these people, hate groups, are doing this?
I think it's partly political, but I also think it's money. Hmm. They're making money out of it. Elon Musk changed the algorithm on X so that we see things that we vehemently disagree with, that we hate, that we want to engage with. Hate kind of forces that engagement. And then for them, it's more money. It's more eyeballs on a screen. Mm. It's more time that you're flicking through. This is the reason why 2 years ago I left X. Oh my God, my life has been so much better since.
Like, I've got a question on that later, but okay. Yes.
But like, when I became chair of Women and Equalities, I thought, where can I speak about this? Where can I speak about topics like heavy menstrual bleeding? Where can I talk about puberty blockers? Where can I talk about women's menstrual health? Where can I talk about disability rights, LGBTQ plus rights? Is it X? No. And the clerks were like, well, we've taken the decision to take the Women and Equalities Committee off X completely, which is the first parliamentary committee to do so. Mm-hmm. But I said, we are not legitimizing this nonsense anymore. And tell me what kind of engagement we were getting. And the engagement we were getting is just hate. Very few of it from people living in the UK, might I add, and very few of them not bots or state-sponsored bots. We've lost nothing. We continue to punch above our weight when it comes to our kind of select committee work. We're not one of the big three traditionally, like, you know, your treasury, your defence, your business. We're Women and Equalities, and we punch above our weight time and time again because our work is so focused on making meaningful change, and every single one of my committee have bought into that, even if they don't agree all the time. And some of them have very, very different viewpoints from others in the committee, but we are focused on making change, and that's what we want to continue to do. And that's not found on X.
Yeah, no, definitely
get
not.
Get off X. Just do it.
Yeah, we should all get off X. Can I also say, Department of Gender Studies, we have left X.
Yay!
We are not on X either. Okay, so I'm just thinking which way to take it, because you've said two very, really interesting things. So I want to ask a bit more about the committee work. Mm-hmm. And I also want to ask about the media stuff, because you were very, very sort of active on X. So let me start off with actually the committee stuff, because I think equality work is often seen very kind of advisory, like you said, you know, it's not one of the big three, rather than it kind of being central. And how do you make sure that your committee is not just symbolic, but is actually disruptive? Because you are disrupting the government. What do you do? I mean, you also have some really horrible disruptors in the committee. I won't take names.
I love the committee work, but for me, it was always about where you can make change. And that's kind of, I think, dominated every decision I've made outside of politics and inside of politics. Where can I make most change? And in 2024, I said to my team, I really want to be the chair of Women and Equalities because this is where the space that I care about, this is where I can make most change. And right off the bat, like, I knew the brilliant work that Caroline Noakes had done with the Women and Equalities Committee beforehand. But I also knew she had a government that just wasn't prepared to listen, whereas I knew that we should have a government that is prepared to listen, but also that we could take some of the debates that you can't have in Parliament anymore. We couldn't have a sensible discussion about puberty blockers in Parliament. Mm. You just couldn't do it in the main chamber. You couldn't do it in Westminster Hall. Select committees are the last place that you could do that. It takes a lot of work to get those balance of arguments and make sure that those people, everybody adheres to the same rules as everybody else within it. But in terms of how we structure our work, we look at the legislative agenda and we see what is coming up and see how we can improve things. I want us to be better. And we did that with the Employment Rights Bill, whether it is the ban on NDAs for sexual abuse and bullying, and pushing on the work that Lou Hague and Can't Buy My Silence had worked on, but also on miscarriage bereavement leave. Mm-hmm. And seeing that, for me, that came full circle because I started that work with so many other trade unionists. Mm-hmm. When I experienced my first miscarriage while working in the trade union, I never thought that we would get it in. I definitely, like, until we had a Labour government, like, there was no chance whatsoever. But to be able to get it in such a monumental piece of employment rights legislation is huge. And we are one of only a handful of countries that now recognise miscarriage and pregnancy loss as the bereavement and loss that it is. Just one of a handful. And I am so proud that our government is the ones that are taking that on. And I'm so proud of our committee's work to change the law That's what committees should be doing. They should be able to change the law. They should be able to shape policies. And they should be able to raise things that nobody else is discussing. Doesn't matter which select committee it is. That's what I think they should all be doing.
And the committee work sort of sits between the sort of critique, but also the constraint that comes with it, right? Because at the same time, you also have a party hat on. So just thinking, no?
Okay. No, I take my party hat off and okay. I ask everybody else to take their party hat off and leave it at the door. Some can manage to do that, some can't. But we are supposed to be working as one. Mm. And that, for me, I think is really important that we kind of hunt as a pack. So quite often you'll see MPs in select committees looking at their phones. They're not playing whatever it is that they're playing or swiping on Tinder or Grindr. They are actually communicating with each other. So we have a WhatsApp group. And if somebody hasn't, like today's, if somebody hasn't answered a question, if one of our witnesses hasn't like fully answered something, or somebody thinks, actually, I know this about this, could you ask this, or I have to leave, we work together. And actually, I learned that on my first select committee, which was Health and Social Care Select Committee. And that was under Jeremy Hunt. And very much just, you know, politically, we didn't see eye to eye, but actually, he was very good at leaving his party hat at the door and would go through Matt Hancock. And that's just brilliant. It's good watch. Yeah.
So it's about cross-party consensus.
It's cross-party consensus, but also holding our government to account. Yeah. I love the Labour Party. Like, I'm Labour through and through. I always have been. My grandparents were Labour Party activists, and my grandma, they had committee rooms until they were in their 90s. So it was always in the background. A grandma is probably the reason why I'm here today doing what I'm doing. But it means that you want them to do better. This is the first Labour government we've had in some people's like lifetime. I want us to be the best that we can be. And like all families, you all have arguments, you have disagreements, but you push each other out of a love and want to do better and get the best out of each other. And that's what I see select committees should be doing. It's scrutinising, it's pushing, it's poking, and it's actually achieving together.
And just kind of talking about, you know, this sort of, so kind of also thinking beyond the kind of committee work, you know, just thinking about the bigger equality agenda around, say, the horrible conversations we are having right now about migration. The horrible conversation we are having now still around Palestine. The other hat you, of course, wear is you are the co-chair of the Labour Friends of Middle East and Palestine. Mm-hmm. And you are also the co-chair of the APPG.
On British Muslims.
On British Muslims.
Yeah.
So I'm also quite interested in how do the conversations that you're having, because in a way, all of these becomes very siloed, but they all work together on gender, on equality. And we don't talk enough about that. How do you put that on the agenda?
I think we put it on the agenda in so many different ways. So yesterday, we had a briefing from, I think it was around 9 ambassadors, and I chaired that meeting, and we brought all of these, and it was cross-party. There were Conservatives, there were Lib Dems, there were Labour, there were no Reform. But it was cross, there was Greens. There was like, you know, it was proper cross-party, bar the obvious exception. And each of the ambassadors gave their updates on what was happening in Palestine. The blockade of aid to Gaza, the continuing infringement on the West Bank. Some talked about the role that kind of Trump had played and what was happening in Iran, and we had the Lebanese ambassador, and she brought pictures of what Beirut had looked like before the bombing. And all of this is steeped in rights, basic rights that have been abused for so long, have been unheard for so long. So I think how I bring them together is that this is, it's rights-based for me. And it's one of the things we've worked so hard to get was to have the recognition of the state of Palestine as the LFPME. But we also know that's only the start. That is just the start for us. But we would never have got there beforehand. We just would never have got there before 2024. My work on the APPG for British Muslims, like, yes, yeah, it's quite weird to have not just a non-Muslim, but an agnostic be a co-chair of the APPG for British Muslims. But I've been the co-chair now for a good few years, and I love it because it says so, like, it shouldn't be left to British Muslims to fight for their rights. It shouldn't be left to British Muslims to champion the work that they do in our society and in our country and the contributions they make. And now, more than ever, people need to stand up alongside people who are being prejudiced against, discriminated against, whether it's trans community in the media, whether it's, you know, there's a report out recently, I think it was yesterday, that said that well over 50% of the news coverage of Muslims in this country was negative. So we cannot just leave it to the people that are affected and to the people that are being attacked to stand up for their own rights. We have to do that together. And I was really psyched when they said, would you like to join us? I was like, yes, of course I would. And on a side note, like during Ramadan, I obviously don't fast because I'm not religious, but I do get invited to a lot of iftars.
That's also a good reason.
It's good. It's a good reason. Yes. It's good food. But as much as we joke about the food point, so when I was Shadow Minister for Faith, Lisa Nandi she was the Shadow Secretary of State for that department. And she'd be like, Sarah, every team meeting, she'd be like, why you come here? Like, I've literally just seen you eat your way around the country. Right? And I'm like, yes, you've seen me eat my way around the country. A, because I love food, but B, because you have the best conversations around food. Right? Sometimes you have really difficult conversations with people, heartbreaking conversations, difficult ones where you don't agree. If you come together afterwards and you eat together, side by side, you share, it's a much more meaningful, much more deep experience, and one that you can actually genuinely have those tough discussions with. So for me, it wasn't just about filling my tummy, it's also about sharing experience with people who should be heard at every level.
Thank you. I want to circle back to the question on online media and kind of, you know, because you are very active online and you were very active on X and you were also a very frequent target. And just kind of, you know, the kind of research I do and what I'm really interested in how that sort of digital hostility has really kind of reshaped what it means for you to be like a very public feminist politician, because you were being attacked. Especially, I remember, you know, between kind of 2020 and 2024 with the real sort of horrible transphobia that was going on. How has it shaped?
I don't know why they attacked me. I'm a mixed race woman who's fairly lefty and cares about rights. I don't know what they had against me. How did it shape me? I think it affected my team and my family as much as it did me. I would say that 95% of the time, I was able to shake it off. I was able to look at, these people don't know me. They don't know who I am. Mm. When you're tired, when you're in a space which isn't, your cup is not as full, then sometimes the awful messages, the awfulness, the targeting gets through. I'm human. I think anybody would experience that. But I think for my team that had to see it day in, day out, it was horrendous. And they weren't signed up for it. Like, that's not something that we need to have. Did it change my way of being? Well, it didn't shut me up. But there were days where my husband would phone me and be like, don't go on X today, don't go on Twitter. And I'd be like, why? And he went, you've been Lawrence Foxed, or you've been, like, you know, targeted, or JK Rowling's had a go at you, or like. And when somebody says don't look at something, your immediate reaction is, I'm going to look at it.
I'm going to look at it.
And I'm like, no, Neil, you didn't help me there, because I don't want to look. But I think the team, the first step, it wasn't like an immediate kind of dumping. It was like a conscious uncoupling. I did full Gwyneth Paltrow. I removed the app from my phone. I stopped looking. I wouldn't be the person that necessarily posted all the time. Sometimes I was really kind of angry in the chamber. I'd reload something on my phone and I'd post it and then I'd see stuff. It shouldn't be that way. Somebody today, one of my local councillors, Jackie Burnett, she was at an event for Labour Africa Network today and she said, MPs have to have rhino skin. But if that's the case, we're not getting the best. Because I know that the best and the brightest actually probably wouldn't part up with this. And we shouldn't be asking anyone to part up with it.
Mm. I mean, there is a lot of emotional labour. You know, you're absorbing all of this hostility. And I think that's rarely kind of acknowledged as work. Because, you know, you are having to do all of that and then go and kind of represent your...
I'd say, yeah, the last election was probably the hardest. It was the most hostile. People would take photos of me, stick them on Facebook, where there were like probably about 50,000 people in this Facebook group. And within about 5 minutes, there would be men in 4x4s driving past shouting abuse. Facebook wouldn't take them down, even though they're pictures that were taken without my consent, that show where I am, that obviously people saying, come here, have a go at you. Is that normal? It's not normal. And I don't know where it stops, because they've made protections, like you're supposed to carry around, you know, your panic alarm. Mm. There's panic alarms in my house. There's buttons in our office, which if you press them, armed police come. So I'm told. We haven't had to press them, so I don't know if they come, but I'm told they do. Even in select committees, we have panic alarms where if we press them, security come. And I don't want to be like America. I want people to come up to me in the supermarket. I want people to be able to talk to me. I want to be able to go out to school fetes and not have like security around me. I want that, because that's like the great British democracy, that some person can come and talk to you about the most important thing in their life when they see you, or the thing that is really annoying them, whether it's a pothole, whether it is like health, whether it's housing. That's, for me, that's a huge part of British democracy, how we hold our surgeries, how accessible British politicians are of every kind of level, whether they're councillors, whether they're MPs. If we continue the way we're going, I worry that we'll lose that.
So looking forward, Sarah, you know, what would be one equality issue that you really think is being systematically deprioritised? I know there's so many, and there's so many you're working on.
There's so many. I think the trans rights issue would be the most obvious. But the one that I really worry about now, and this is how it starts, and this is how it started with the trans rights debate, is about women being made to feel less than if they don't choose to have children or if they cannot have children. It started now in that kind of insidious way. It was just up for debate. We saw it with the Gorton and Denton reform candidate saying, well, you know, we'll increase taxes on women who haven't had kids. Oh, it's just up for debate. It's just up for debate. And that's how it starts. Mm-hmm. And it's insidious. Then it becomes, let's have a look at the abortion rights. Are they too lenient? Then it's like, what are we doing to ensure that women are staying at home and having babies? We've seen this play out time and time again. We've seen it in America. I don't believe that the British public want that. I don't. In my heart of hearts. But does that mean that we won't be subjected to it? No, because we already are. And that for me is one of the ones that they are, it's a deliberate attack. It's not even a subtle kind of, they're not subtle about it. It's deliberate. And it's because they want to take away our freedom, they want to take away our rights, and they want to take away our voices. And they want to make money out of it. And I can't stand them.
It's a very hostile times, Sarah. What gives you hope?
Chocolate? Nah. What gives me hope? Corny as it is, but young people give me hope. Like, whenever I go to schools, like, there's my favourite thing is to go to schools. There's no filter, there's nothing. But what gives me hope is that people don't stop talking. You will have noticed I've got my little butterfly here today.
Yes.
Today I got given this. I met three incredible women today, this morning, and they are victims of Jeffrey Epstein. And they came to the UK today, yesterday. They spoke on Good Morning Britain today. And the hope for me is that we don't stop speaking out. It doesn't matter how powerful they are. It doesn't matter where in the world they come from. My hope is that we aren't silenced. The fact that they're able to give me this today to share their experiences, that's my hope, that we are not silenced and that you can't put us back in a box. That's what I want, and that's what I hope for.
Sarah Owen, people.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So, Let's take a little break. You have some water. Excellent. And I am going to use the last half of this for Q&A. So we'll take a bunch of questions over here.
That was faster than I thought.
You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Denise Mitchell. I'm an LSE alum. I'm really happy to be here today, and it was wonderful to hear you speak. My question, so obviously, globally, there has been a backlash to diversity, equity, and inclusion movements. I prefer to say it the entire way instead of DEI, because I feel like DEI softens it. At the same time, we've just had a major movement here in the UK to strengthen workforce protections. I wonder what your thoughts are for women in the workplace who are currently navigating or have previously navigated challenges as it relates to DEI, and how they can move forward and, I guess, galvanize other women that have been victims of the backlash.
Thank you very much. Should we take another one? There,
in
the
back, there. Top. Hi, Sarah. Hi, everyone. I'm Sian, and Sarah and I know each other. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing everything. And I think I'm so struck by you talking about being the first. As a fellow person who is mixed race, of East and Southeast Asian heritage, from a working class background, with a mum who came here to be a nurse, it means so much to me personally to see you representing people, not just in your constituency, but from our, and I have an ambivalent relationship with the word community, but from our quote unquote community. My question is, you touched on it a little bit, but I'm interested to know if you feel comfortable sharing how or whether your mixed race identity and heritage has informed your political outlook.
And we'll take one online and then we'll do the next round. Neela, over here, if we can take one of the online questions.
Thank you so much. There's a question online from Pippi, who's asking about your work on the miscarriage bereavement leave and kind of why it sometimes seems that kind of wins or these like positive things or this positive stuff that's going on doesn't really cut through, and like the broader story seems to be like one of decline. So like how do you think, or what we could do to bring these decisions to the surface better and communicate wins?
Amazing. Thank you. I'm going to start with Denise. So yeah, equality, diversity and inclusion. I think we're seeing a rollback. It's a mismatch, right? So we have so many international companies and global corporations that work in the UK, and they are rowing back because that is what America is wanting. And there are American companies based in America, but they work here. And we have seen a huge rollback in rights in terms of just even how they advertise as well and how they speak about themselves publicly, because they do not want to annoy the powers that be within America. Some of them will have government contracts, some won't. And they also have to play to a global market. So some have actually, that I've seen and spoken with, have taken a deliberate step to not eradicate them in the UK, because they can't, because they still have to work by our laws. But they don't put them front and center. It's a quiet quitting, kind of like, I'm not talking about this. But we know when it comes to EDI and diversity, if we are not shouting about it, it doesn't work. Because what we have still isn't good enough for the majority of people. So when they do take that deliberate step back, even if they haven't changed their policies in the UK, it means that it's just not working. Because you have to be proactive. And my answer to that, and I'm sure Rohit's will be as well, join trade unions. Join a trade union and get loud, because, and get organised, because there will be people in the same boat as you, and our trade union movement needs to be there to ensure that when we pass those laws and that legislation, that companies and bosses actually stick to it, and they are held to account for it as well. It's not just good enough for us to sit here and say, oh yeah, we've passed legislation. We've got to hold the bosses to account. So the job is only half done. Sian, I love you, and you are representing as well in every way. And mixed heritage, it's... Right, I think from my mixed heritage, I learned from a really early age, I am too much for some people and not enough for others. I walk into a Chinese restaurant with Jenny, who I'm trying to teach her how to eat spicy food. I'm failing miserably. We went to a Sichuan restaurant, Labour Party conference, and she was livid when they gave me a knife and fork. And she was like, no. She's mixed race, give her the chopsticks. But yet, for that man on Facebook who said she's not even English, I was too much. And so I think this mixed heritage, dual heritage, whatever way you look at it, we don't talk about that enough in the equality field. Like, you are not half of something, you are both of something. I am so proud of my East and Southeast Asian roots. Like, I am so proud. I am so proud of my British part too. And I have the best of both worlds in my family, in my experience, in my DNA. But outside, I'm still not seen as quite enough or too much in some respects. And I think that that is really, really hard. I think it's so hard for so many mixed heritage people to have to grapple with, to deal with. They feel almost like they have to choose one or the other. And even when I go back to Malaysia, I'm seen as really Western. And people be like, well, you know, you're mixed race, your mum's Malaysian, but you were brought up in the UK. And I was like, yeah, I was brought up in the UK. By who? My mum. My dad. Right? So just because of where you're brought up doesn't mean that your culture isn't what it should be, like what you feel it should be as well. And I think it's played a big part in... I'm never going to please everyone. I knew that when I was going to be Women and Equalities, when there were people that said to me, are you mad? You want to go into the Women and Equalities space right now, given everything that's happening and the context of like the conversations, the language, the abuse, the kind of, if you say one thing, you're going to annoy another person. I went into it knowing I wasn't going to please everyone. And do you know what? I've always never pleased everyone since the day I was born. And I'm going to continue not pleasing everyone, and I don't care. Bibi, thank you so much for that question on miscarriage bereavement leave. How do we get, like, cut through on things like that? Well, first of all, we have, like, I think a change in media outlets. Traditional media are wanting to talk about real life. They call it human interest stories. For them, miscarriage bereavement leave was a mix between human interest and politics. We know one in four pregnancies end in miscarriage and pregnancy loss. So that's a quarter of people that are pregnant will lose their baby. And it's a campaign, along with Miscarriage Association and many other organisations, that they've worked so hard to get this. And how do we cut through to the mainstream? It's all over their Instagram. I can't move for it. I don't know whether algorithms are different. I'll come back to that bit in a minute. But for miscarriage bereavement leave, on the day of the announcement that the government had accepted our amendment and we're going to put it through, we were on Good Morning Britain, we were on ITV, we were on Channel 4, we were on BBC in the morning. Like, we couldn't have been more around. But how do we continue to hammer those wins home and own them? Own them as ours, right? Is so important. And when it comes to the women's health space, I want to challenge the social media companies for their shadow banning of the things that matter to us. So if you have doctors, qualified doctors, talking about miscarriage, bereavement loss, if you have the words in your videos, vulva, vagina, clitoris, you get marked down. You get shadow banned, as it were, even if you're a doctor talking about it. And where do we go when we get ignored by our doctors? We go to the internet. We go to our family, friends, obviously. But the first place is you Google it. You look. You go online, you have a look, Instagram. I'm like constantly like, am I ruining my child? Like, you know, you go on there. But if all of the information about women's health and women's bodies is pushed down to the bottom by social media companies and tech bros like Elon Musk, there is a massive barrier to information that we need to see. And from people that are so qualified to give it, people like Nigat Arif, people like Dr. Cisse, like Chella Quinn, there are amazing people out there working in this space. They have brilliant TikTok following, they have brilliant like Instagram following, they go on television, they talk about these things, whether it's miscarriage, bereavement, whether it is menopause, whether it is fibroids, PMDD, adenomyosis, endometriosis. But the tech companies push their content down, they suppress it. And that's one of the things that I think will come out. I can't predetermine it, but I'm pretty sure that's something that our committee will be pushing forward later on. Nice.
Okay, we're going to take some more questions. Wow, okay, many. I am going to first go back there, and then we'll take two over there, and then, okay.
Hello, Ms. Owen. Thank you very much for your lovely talk. My name is Chris Parks. I'm a senior lecturer at King's College London. I'd like to ask you a question about your work on the Women's Inequality Committee. I've watched it very closely, and I've been very impressed. Your interrogation of Baroness Faulkner was a thing of beauty and a wonder to behold.
Thank you.
But I'm a bit perplexed by the way that you described what you're doing there as trying to make change, because despite your interrogation, Baroness Faulkner's interim guidance is still in effect and been declared legal. Despite your committee's rejection of her appointment, Marianne Stevenson is now the head of the EHRC. And I must note that your own party, in response to the recent Supreme Court ruling from the Scottish Minister's case, decided to cancel its women's conference and then subsequently bar trans women from the subsequent one. Is this really a record of someone making change on that committee?
Thank you very much. Yes.
Hi, Sarah. My name is Radhika. I'm a PhD student at the Gender Department. Thank you so much for this. I found your words very inspiring. And there was this thing that you said that really got me going. You said something about how you respond to people who speak to you about opinions that you disagree with on a daily basis. And that's where my question is coming from. I think, like, not only in the UK, I think globally, we're living in a very polarized world. And I think a lot of people are really struggling to have daily conversations with people who disagree with them. And of course, not conversations that border on hatred and, you know, worse, right? And I just was wondering how you navigate these conversations on a daily basis.
Thank you very much. I'll take one online and then I will come to you in the next round. Yes, just Neela again. Yes, one of the online questions. Do you have a lot?
Thank you so much. The next question online is from Susanna, who's an independent researcher in London. And she's asking about the right to speak out and the right to protest in this current climate and wants to know more about what the Equalities Committee can do when the current climate feels very repressive to those rights.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So first of all, Chris, there are limitations to what I can change as a select committee chair. I don't have any powers, direct powers. There are days that I wish that I did, so many days. But what we can do is push and push in the right direction. I think we, and be true to ourselves on it. Like, when you saw me questioning the EHRC, that is us true to ourselves. Do we have the position, do we have the power to remove her? No, we don't. I can't change that either. But what I can do is give the evidence as to why it was we thought she wasn't suitable for it and why the other committee also found that she wasn't suitable for it. So it was a joint committee. That doesn't happen very often. So for people who don't know and don't follow Women and Equalities as much as Chris does, thanks for being the only viewer online for us. But we also, so one of our roles is to scrutinise the work of the EHRC and also to question and find out the suitability of the chair. We've just seen the change of the chair, and that's the Joint Human Rights Committee as well that also do this work. We had complained about the process. We aren't given anybody else to scrutinise. We don't see any who's applied. All we get from the government is this is the person that we want to nominate for the position. And we asked questions. And they weren't just questions about human rights. They were about experience. They were about values. They were about kind of suitability, plans for the future, all of those things. And it's true. Both committees unanimously decided not to support her. Now, the process is that we can only make that recommendation to the ministers. I can't tell the minister you cannot endorse her or that you cannot put her as chair of EHRC. We can just give our recommendations based on the facts that we saw before us. It's up to them to take the decision, and they did take the decision that they wanted to go ahead, despite what we said, despite our reservations, despite the evidence that we had to say that's not the way forward. So I think in terms of success, I worry about the things I can control. And what was in my control was scrutinizing the suitability of the person in front of me and giving honest, constructive, evidenced feedback as to the suitability for that person for the role. What was not in my control was whether the ministers agreed with me or not. And now, what I worry is that in a general election's time, whether we're even going to have an EHRC at a time when we really need it the most. So I wanted the strongest person to be there. I hope that they prove us wrong. And that's yet to be seen. When it comes to my party's own position, I was in that speech for LGBT History Month, I was critical of my own party, and I am not afraid to be. It guts me. I used to love going to women's conference at Labour Party. Like, it's where, like, oh, A, I felt safe. B, it was collegiate and collaborative. I chaired huge meetings full of women that wanted to change the world and change our party, change our country. And I've said, I'm not going. I'm not going this year. If all women can't go, I'm not going. And again, I don't have the power to make my party change their mind on this, but I have the power of my own agency and my own voice, and that's what I can control. Disagreeing well, oh my goodness, it's so hard, right? I think social media, COVID, the polarization of discourse and language, all of this has just meant that we forget how to disagree well. Like, we really do. And that's not just in politics. That's in every walk of life, right? All of a sudden, the knobhead uncle, like, at every family function, it's not just like, oh, he's a knobhead and he's in the corner, we're not going to talk to him. It's like, bring it on, right? And it's really hard, like, to balance that, because is their opinion coming from fear? Is it becoming from a different place? Where can you find agreement? There are times where you can find agreement with people that you fundamentally disagree with. It's really hard to do that. You know about the miscarriage bereavement leave work? There's somebody who I said to you that I fundamentally disagreed with, and he told me to shut up about, like, rape statistics, all of those things. There is nothing that we agree on apart from miscarriage bereavement leave. And that's a Reform MP, right? There can be agreement, but it takes so much effort. It's so much easier to just be like, I don't like you, you're doing my nut, like, please leave me alone, don't talk to me. And there are days where that's completely fine, because we all have our own capacities on different days, right? But if we continue to just live in our own bubble and talk and listen to people who we agree with only, it's going to become more divisive. And it's easier for the powers that be to pick us all off. It really is, to play one another off against each other. And I want to just share something. Actually, it kind of touches on Ian and probably my experience growing up in Hastings. When I went to the first day of secondary school, you know when you go in for a taster day? I went in and there were two girls sat in front of me. And they turned around at me and they were doing the pulling the eyes. They were doing fake Chinese accents, the buck teeth, the... yeah. Chopsticks as pens, those sorts of things. Like, really unoriginal, boring, bullying, basic, racist nonsense. But, you know, teenage girls. And one of them, in about a year's time, she bought a massive knife into school. And she showed it to two of my friends, Claire and Laura. I didn't see it, but Claire and Laura came up to me and they were white as a sheet. And they were like, she's brought a knife in to kill you because she doesn't believe that races should mix. And my parents came in, they were just like, there is no way that this should be allowed to happen. This is awful. I was a bit like in shock, to be honest. I was a bit like, well, in my head, I'd kind of separated it that I just hadn't really believed that this was true. This girl obviously did have a knife because she went into the bathroom and she hacked her own hair off with it because she was so angry. Now, there are obviously so many horrendous things that were happening for that girl. Like, a young girl does not come out with races shouldn't mix, particularly kind of pre-internet times, and B, to hack your own hair off in the bathroom, like, and C, bring a knife into school to do that. And I hope that now, like, now I look at it back, I hope that she got the help that she needed. But there was the other girl. And the other girl, she became like my friend. And we would mess about together. We would, oh God, we always ate so many sweets. I definitely think she was the person I had a cigarette with first. Like, it was, she was lovely. And then eventually one day she said to me, I'm so sorry for how I behaved on that first day of school. She was like, I just didn't know better. And I think we have to have space in our hearts that A, people can learn and change, and B, that sometimes the most horrific actions and the most hurtful things that are coming out of somebody's mouth, it's not about you, it's about them and what they're going through. That does not excuse poor behaviour, that does not excuse the monetization of hatred that we're seeing on a mass scale. But for individuals, sometimes it can be really, really hard to listen to the things that they have to say. But I always hold hope that people will change. But not Elon Musk. He will always be an asshole. So that's disagreeing well. Susanna, the right to speak out and to protest. I've always believed in the right to protest. I took my little girl on her first protest before she could walk. I think I'm probably about a month away before she starts protesting against me, and she's six. I think it's a fundamental right. I do not like what we are seeing right now. I do not agree with it. I don't agree with the immigration proposals at all. For me, I think there is something fundamentally wrong and broken that we are saying.
Your WhatsApp's got leaked on that. You know that, right? I love that.
I don't put anything on WhatsApp that I don't expect to leak. Like, I'm not naive on that front. Like, I really don't. I mean, it annoys me that it does, because it shouldn't. It should be a safe space. But yeah, when the party asks me to share something I disagree with, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say no. Have a conversation with me. Ask why it is that, like, me and a lot of other people also don't agree with, and how it's going to impact people. When you tell me that a child of a care worker has to wait 13 years for settled status, but the child of a banker gets to wait 3 years, I'll tell you why that's unfair. I've been a care worker. Value to this society and this country should not just be based on your income. It's based on what you want to bring. There are 111,000 vacancies for care work at the moment. I've been one. And when I started being a care worker, no one in my family thought I'd stick it out, right? Because I'm quite princessy. I don't know if you noticed, I've got heels. I love my makeup, right? But it turns out I love people more. I loved doing that job, but it's not a job for everyone. It's not a job for everyone to give somebody really intimate care. It's not a job for everybody to feed somebody who can no longer feed themselves, or to communicate with somebody who's lost the ability to speak. Like, that's not a job for everyone. To me, that's a skilled job. And I don't care which Home Secretary is in power.
Yeah.
Care is a skilled job, and I will argue that to the cows come home.
Okay, we'll take a few more questions. I'm going to first go there because you hadn't spoken. It's in the leather jacket, then you. Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for talking. As also, my name is Tyler. I'm a master's student here at LSE in social psychology. As also a mixed race person, I really appreciate you speaking about your experience. I'm really interested personally in Welsh politics, and Wales Labour Party has produced some really interesting things of like anti-racist by 2030 policy. They have a nation of sanctuary policy to, in their words, to go against the hostile UK culture of refugees and use their devolved powers. And there's future generations as well. So like a lot of very progressive things, but they're still part of the same Labour Party. One, I guess, is this a further argument for Wales to become independent, to be able to produce these more progressive laws? But also secondly, what are the constraints and differences between the two Labour parties? Because they're the same party, but from my experience here, they're not acting as the same.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, not two. Who else? How many others?
Thank Thank you so much for the speech, for the conversation, probably. I'm Veronica, and postgrad from inequalities and social sciences from LSE, and now I'm just finding my space into all this interweaving journey. So many aspects you've touched upon on identity, gender, culture. You also mentioned that you love speaking to the young people, give them some hope, and you also come with hope. I think my question is, I want to put a few puzzles. I don't know if you're aware, today was probably one of the most historical events in New York when the Commission Status on Women didn't unanimously voted on gender equality, and there were quite a few aggressive countries expressing their views on ambiguity of the gender language and so forth. With this kind of signaling and message that America is the leading country in this abstracting gender equality, and also other countries picking up on it, and you said that we are quite fragile in this kind of space as well. What do you say to young people, especially with all the digital space right now, with all the misogyny playing out in different kind of ways? What do you say to young people? How do they not fall into those traps of division, of going with that kind of narratives, very, very harmful narratives? Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to take the person back there. Yeah? You. Yeah, you.
Me?
Okay.
That was so polite.
That's very sweet. Go on.
So, I disagree with a bit of what you're saying. It's no surprise to me that men are moving to the right. Why aren't you guys trying to address the arguments put forward by the right and rebut them? Because I don't see it at all.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. So that's three questions. How many more? Can I just see a show of hands? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's it.
Cool.
Okay.
Right.
Afterwards, yes.
It's cool. Tyler. Yeah, Welsh politics, actually, despite my surname being Owen, is not a strength of mine. But what I would say is that the Labour Party is a family, right? And within it, you have a lot. It's a broad church, and I think we're stronger for it, and we have to listen to different people, rather than it being the Welsh Labour Party being more progressive, being an argument for them stepping back. I actually think it's an argument for them being more involved. Drag us with you. Don't separate. That's what I would want to see. And that's the same for the Scottish Labour Party as well. I actually think they should be dragging us to a better place, particularly on the equalities issues, absolutely. And having worked in Scotland, in politics, it is harsh. Are any of you planning on working in Scotland at any stage? Right, okay, I don't want to put you off. Like, A, it's beautiful and the people are lovely, but B, the journalists and the media, if we think that, like, London lobbies are really hard, the Scottish lobby is really hard. It's really patriarchal, it's really old, it's very white, and it's very combative, really combative. So I think that there are things that we can learn from one another, but for me, if either Scotland or Wales are being more progressive, I want them to drag us, not separate. Veronica, yeah, CSW. So this is the first time in a number of years that the Women and Equalities Select Committee has not gone to CSW in New York. I asked my committee if this is what they wanted to do. So I was due to go with the committee last year, but it was the Employment Rights Bill, and I had to stay to table the amendment on miscarriage bereavement leave. Very glad I did. But for me, I don't want to go to talking shops. And I'm not saying that it isn't important, but what change is going to come out of it? And I also wanted to guarantee the safety of all of my committee members. Given what's happening in America, I don't think I could guarantee that, particularly some of my more outspoken members and me. Like, I mean, I'm on record of being pretty anti-Trump. I'm on record on being anti-Elon Musk. And yeah, I wanted to guarantee their safety. And for me, it's sad that we wouldn't be going. It doesn't mean that we won't go in future years. But I think that there is a real international call here for women to unite together, because the issues that we're facing, they're not just what we're facing alone in the country. A lot of the abuses, whether it's in the online space especially, that needs international cooperation. So we've strengthened our non-consensual intimate image abuse laws. But actually 20% of non-consensual intimate image abuse files and images and videos are stored in countries that do not comply. And that's still a large number. So even if we manage to get takedown of somebody's image in this country or in other countries that do comply, that image still circulates on the internet. So we need to have an international solution to do that. Mm. Is CSW the best place to do that? I don't know right now. I really don't. When it comes to young people, and this, I think, goes to your point, why aren't I doing anything about the far right and also the right rebuttal? I actually think so. Today, I had a two-hour select committee inquiry session on the Manosphere and misogyny. And this goes to your question as well about like young people and hope and where we give them space. And we had two men in front of us, James Bloodworth and James Blake. James Blake is an award-winning documentary maker. He's 27, 28. He's worked in that space where he was, after a relationship breakup, he ended up down the kind of Manosphere route. James Bloodworth, in a similar space, he'd said he'd suffered some grief, and he went down that pathway, ended up down the red pill, the kind of alt-right, saw all of that, and came out the other end. Both of them have, but they also try and work and to understand. So I think rebutting it is one thing. So like I am really vocal about how it's not true, it's not X, Y, Z, that this isn't right, that this isn't the best way to go about it. But where's the alternative? And that's what we were trying to work with today. And I think one of the big issues is around the loneliness aspect. And not loneliness as I'm a lonely man by myself. No, the loneliness of not having the third space. So James Blake said something really powerful today. He said he was talking with kind of 12 to 20-year-olds that had fallen into the Manosphere and the alt-right space. And when he said, would you not, like, they'd all travelled to Portugal and hired, like, a house together. And this was their only friendship group. There were people they'd met online. And when he said, well, do you not go out and meet other people, like, in real life, in your community, in your town, in your city? And they were like, no, we haven't got a space to. And he was like, do you not have a youth club? And all of the men there and the boys didn't know what a youth club was. Yeah. They did not know what a youth club was. So I think that part of the rebuttal isn't just challenging the myths that is perpetuated by the right, and particularly by right-wing media outlets and politicians. Political entrepreneurs is what James Bloodworth called them today. Mm. And I agree with that. But it's also challenging it with a view of an alternative. I don't believe that any child, like that girl that brought in the knife to see me, I don't believe that she was born racist. I don't believe she was born to believe that races shouldn't mix. I believe she was taught that. If she was given other support, other avenues, other space, then that's where we need to be. And I think for a large part of our society in the UK, where we are seeing the right come to prominence, it's not just the othering that is the issue. It's the fact that they have been forgotten. It is the fact that they have had every community surface ripped out of their communities. It is the fact that they were mining towns that were left with absolutely nothing. They've got services on their knees. They can't get a house. They can't get a doctor's appointment. This isn't just an issue for the right. It's about having a fairer society for all. And I think it's not just rebutting the wrongness of necessarily the argument, it's about creating a positive alternative as well.
And I think what you've just mentioned about the lack of community spaces, you know, 14 years of Tory austerity has brought local authorities, like say Newham, £300 million we've lost. And where do you have money for anything outside statutory services? And that's something we are absolutely having to question. Okay, we've got 10 minutes. Can I have the people? One, two, three.
Hi there, my name is Monica. I was in the gender department last year and now I work in policy research. I found it really heartening to hear you talk about how you pull together with a lot of the select committee members, especially given, you know, a lot of the very sad and depressing things that we've touched on. So obviously share as much or as little as you feel comfortable doing, but I'd love to hear a little more about that and maybe also cases where you feel cross-party debate really has worked, has been fruitful, and you've been able to find common ground where maybe you weren't expecting it. Thank you.
There, that was number two there. Yeah. And who was the third person? Yeah, go on.
Hi, I'm Maria. I'm a Year 12 student in sixth
form.
I really appreciate you touching on the youth and your fulfillment with working with the youth. And as a young person myself, specifically a young woman, I was just wondering what you would recommend to young people like me to do in order to speak out about issues which are relevant to us, despite often not being taken seriously.
And here. Yes.
Hi, I'm Tessa. I'm doing a master's here at LSE in gender policy and inequalities. And my question is, to what extent should childcare reform be seen as an issue of gender equality in itself? And do you think that the government's recent expansion of childcare goes far enough to address the structural inequality faced by women, particularly mothers, in this country?
Thank you very much. Those are the final questions, and over to you.
Oh, you're so strict, Ryan. Did you say your name was Veronica or Monica? Monica, great. So how we pull together, I think when we discuss really, there will be conversations that have happened in select committees that are in closed spaces as well, in private spaces, that you will never unhear. You will fail to be touched. It doesn't matter which part of the political spectrum you're from. So we heard from FGM survivors in the UK, and we've managed to get change on that as well. We've managed to secure funding from the government for more research into where we need to see corrective surgery outlets and help. We look after each other. It's difficult. People have really different views on there. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And at times it is hard to manage, but my job as chair is to ensure that we have a safe space for everybody to be heard, even when what people are saying they really disagree with. It's not always the easiest. But after every session, particularly some of the most harrowing sessions that we've had, we all stop. We all make sure that everybody's okay before we leave the room. And I remind them every time that there is counselling available, there is all of those things available. And that actually, I think, when you hear things that people have gone through, the absolute horrors that you've gone through, it makes you question your differences with the person sat next to you. Does it mean that that feeling is lessened or that the actual arguments is lessened? No. Mm-hmm. But the necessity to be awful to that person next to you, when you've just listened to somebody go through some of the most awful things you could ever possibly imagine, it makes you, gives you a bit of a reality check. And if it doesn't, then you need to give your head a wobble, right? How we come together. Like, I constantly say about the C word and not that C word.
I wasn't thinking that.
All the other C words. No, it's about compromise. People in politics have forgotten the art of compromise as well as the art to disagree well. Compromise seems to be like a dirty word. Like, oh, they compromised on this. Oh, they compromised on that. Actually, for me, if I have to compromise on something and it's better than it was before, that's still a win. It's something to build on. I am not going to sit there and say, I am not compromising until it is absolutely how I want it to be. No. Because if it means that I have to compromise a little bit of where I want it to be to see progress and to see that go through together, then I'm an adult. That's the way it is. And I think that's kind of what we're losing in adult politics as well at the moment. So yeah, I would never forget the C word, compromise, when it comes to collaborative working. Because progress is progress and we can't take it for granted. Tessa, I'm going to come to you because I'm coming to you last, Maria, okay? Tessa, there you are. Hi. Childcare review. No, it's not just a female issue. It goes to the heart of, like, our society. So for me, when we talk about childcare, getting it right actually is an economical issue as well. Like, we would have billions more in the economy if we could just get people back into work, if they wanted to get back into the workspace, if we gave men paternity leave that wasn't just 2 weeks in this country. Oh, they'd be able to bond with their child. What would that mean in terms of, like, tackling quite a lot of the masculinity issue? What that means for being a positive male role model. And also for women like me who have had a C-section, you can't lift a kettle up for 6 weeks. Practically, I needed somebody there for 6 weeks. And also that there shouldn't be exceptions for men to take time out of the workplace. So I'm sat here now. I was 7.5 months pregnant when the election was called in 2019, and I put myself forward. And I'd already had 2 miscarriages at this stage. It was a tough decision, but I felt more and more angry. I don't know if it was pregnancy hormones, but I was like, I am not gonna let my child be brought up under another Tory government. But I had 2 months basically between getting elected and setting up my office and her being born. And I worked up until 2 days before her due date. One of the whips, who wasn't my whip, he saw me kind of like really waddling, and he was like, I'm not your whip, but should you be here? And I was like, I don't know, I'm still here. I'm not giving birth until like next week. And he was like, could you go home? But she was born 5 weeks before lockdown happened. I just set up the office. I just hired staff. Like, Luton is an airport town. I'd had the C-section. And my husband looked at me and he knew I needed to go back to work and that I wanted to go back to work, right? And he said, I'll stay at home. And he quit his job. And he stayed at home for 1.5 years and he raised her. Like, I raised her too, but I went back to work. Because A, the constituency needed it. B, I couldn't sit there and just let this happen. And C, why shouldn't he stay at home and look after the baby, right? He's better at it than me. I'll be blunt. When it came to that stage of her life, he was better at it. He was more equipped for it. Not totally equipped for it, like, but, you know, I still... Yeah. But when I went back to work, a really well-meaning, lovely MP was like, hey, Sarah, you're back. Where's baby? And I was like, well, she's at home. He was like, well, who's looking after her? And I was like, her dad. And it was like a revelation. And he said, oh, that's very good of him. And I said, yes. As it has been good of every other woman who has done that before. And he went, right you are, Sarah. I stand corrected, and I shouldn't have said that. And I was like, yay, learning. But yeah, childcare isn't just a women's issue. It's a men's issue as well. Like, he has a bond with our daughter that he would never have had. Like, and he cherishes that. He cherishes that. And the moment she's going through a mummy phase, which is really hard for him because she's at home now, probably screaming in his face, going, I want mum. But as a kid, like, he knows now that he's got that resilience. He's got that bond that will never be broken. And it's beautiful. And it's so good for all of us, not just for me. So, yeah. Sorry, that was a bit much on childcare, wasn't it? Do I think it's gone far enough? No. 30 hours free childcare is brilliant. Like, it is so much better than it was. But childcare is expensive. And we all live very far away from our parents now and our kind of like social, our networks. It used to be like, I used to spend so much time with my grandparents, my mum and dad. My dad was a firefighter. My mum was a nurse. They worked shifts, which meant that my grandparents looked after us. They raised us, really. Mum and dad paid for us and fed us and obviously were our parents. But the people who did like the stories at bedtime, the kind of emotional learning, the political education from my grandma, like that came from them. But we know that we don't live in a society where that is afforded to everybody now. So no. Maria, you're in year 12. That was awesome. Thank you so much for the question. How to speak out on issues that matter to you and what to do when you aren't taken seriously. Like, if the person that you're speaking to isn't taking you seriously, speak to somebody else because they don't deserve to hear from you, is what I'm going to say, right? If people in positions of power are not listening to young people, they're idiots, right? And they are not proper representatives. I go to primary schools and I tell primary school children they're my boss because they are. And I mean it. Because for the last 3 years, every time I've gone into a school, they've said to me, our play parks in Luton are rubbish. They are trash, right? I know they are because I take my 6-year-old and she's like, this isn't great. And you've got broken fortresses, you've got zip lines that don't work, you've got peeling, certain pits that are dirty, peeling paint off them. And that's because of the years of austerity that we've had, where we've had to spend as local authorities on the very basics, right? We haven't had stuff for the niceties. So every single primary school I've gone to has told me this. Before the autumn statement, I went in to see Rachel Reeves in number 11. And we were there to talk about how we support people into work and talk about welfare and disabilities in my role as select committee chair. She did ask me, is there anything in Luton? I said, yeah, actually there is. The state of our parks are a disgrace. And I know every local authority has a list of the disrepair and the state of disrepair for their parks. Every local authority have it. So I was like, any money that you can spare on this, A, isn't just good for our community. It's good for the child to get them off the screens, talking with one another. It's healthy. And importantly, for so many families, it's free. Mm. It's free. I didn't really think anything of it. And she spoke in the autumn statement, and then she was like, oh, and I thank the member for Luton North. And I was like, what? What's coming next? What have I done? And she dedicated £18 million of the national budget to narrating parks. Now, she shouldn't have thanked me. She should have thanked the kids that had lobbied me for 3 years. And when I go to schools and I say, I take you seriously, when you open your mouth and you ask for something, I will find an opportunity to ask for it. Mm. And if your representatives aren't doing that, they are idiots. Because I go and tell those children that they haven't just changed the play parks in Luton, they're going to change the play parks across the whole of the UK. Yeah. And they, if we get it right for them, and we get it right for them first time round, they're not going to be the adults in the future that are saying, this isn't what I wanted. They're going to say, how do I build on this? So I really hope that you are listened to and that you are heard, because you have definitely been heard tonight.
Sarah Owen, everyone.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.